Okay, yeah, so I like this form of writing, this kind of electronic structure Hamiltonian, because these are operators, these ends, but they kind of look like densities, right? So, I mean, they will measure the density if you take an expectation value, but they're really operators, so there's actually a lot of like correlations that can happen here as well. Okay, so that's kind of interesting, but I like this form. And it's especially handy for understanding where the kind of exact principles of this Hohenberg-Cohen-Sham DFT formalism come from, because basically you can see that there's like kind of a symmetry here in the sense that the density, the only thing that couples to this external potential is the density, right? And so there's kind of like you can think of also as the as one coupling to the other, or the other coupling to the first. So you can kind of flip them around in some sense. So we can kind of think of, you know, the V as the input to our problem and get a wave function. We can kind of think of the N as the input to our problem in some sense. Yeah, so that's, yeah, so yesterday we kind of rewrote it in a suggestive form for the case of a Slater determinant. So yeah, let's talk about that right now. That was kind of the next thing I was going to mention. So if you write this out, this is, so sum over sigma here. And let's put the sums in the front. Mean, sometimes you'll see this written in other forms. Like sometimes people will take these operators and kind of scramble them up, you know, and that might change the overall Hamiltonian by some constant shift or something like that. But you know, if you just kind of choose one order, you know, and then don't worry too much about the constants or define the constants as an extra contribution, then I like this form a little better because it's sort of in terms of this density. And then what we talked about, one thing we talked about yesterday was that the idea of Hartree-Fock is that you want to minimize. Expectation value of this guy in a Slater determinant. So this notation phi kind of stands for Slater determinant. So we want to minimize over all such phi over this expectation value. And for the case of these kinds of wave functions, that they have the property that if you put this kind of operator inside, just kind of schematically, that they have this property that that when you take expectation values of more than two of these creation annihilation operators, you can always break it up into just sums over just, you know, products of these pairs. So basically you can what's this called again? The name is blanking out of my head. So, where you can just contract, like you can just take these two, and then you can also do this channel. Yeah, Wick's theorem. Thank you. Okay, just the name flew out of my head. Exactly. So these kinds of wave functions obey, you know, this property Wick's theorem, right? So it's only for these non-interacting kinds of wave functions, right? So it's like a property of that structure, and so you can decompose this more complicated correlation function just into sums of these more simple products of just two operator correlation functions, right? So then the one where you decompose it this way, what you're doing is you're kind of recovering back these density operators individually and putting just putting the wave function in the middle. You get back just this Hartree term where basically you kind of just erase these operators. You know, they just really become the density. And then the other way of contracting, you get this exchange term, right? But this kind of simple decomposition into these two terms, that's a property of this kind of Slater determinant kind of wave function. So in general, there's other corrections, and that's what we would call correlation effects, right? So basically anything that's not captured in this kind of simple ansatz, you would say is some kind of correlation effect or some kind of correlation contribution to the energy. Also, you know, in addition, there's correlation effects back in the kinetic energy part too. So I'm just kind of talking more loosely. So really you also have to account for the fact that this part will be affected by having a different structure of the wave function, of course. Okay, so that's just kind of one board review. So now we're going to move away from Hartree-Fock, right? So that's still very useful as kind of a reference point. When people do chemistry, for instance, quite a lot, they use Hartree-Fock. People still use Hartree-Fock as a way to think about simple weakly correlated condensed matter systems. But now we're going to talk more about DFT. Okay, density functional theory. And like I said, it's actually a it's a rewriting of quantum mechanics. Okay, so we're actually going to like move away from wave functions and then try to formulate quantum mechanics just in terms of the density, right? And so it's not, you know, all of quantum mechanics. I'm just talking about quantum mechanics of electrons, right? So, you know, you can't necessarily build the same formalism up for like bosons or something because of some different properties that they obey. But here we're, you know, we're always thinking about electrons. Okay, so as we know, yeah, actually fermions more generally, yeah. But we're mostly thinking about the case with spin, just unless I say otherwise. But I may, yeah, in fact, even today, I think I'll give an example where we talk about spinless fermions just because it's simpler sometimes. Yeah, good question. So as we know, in regular quantum mechanics, you can get the you can get the ground state energy by just minimizing this functional. Well, actually, I could probably even remove the quotes. It really is a functional. It's E of psi. We don't usually talk about it this way. Usually, we just write this. And if you want to work in like a first quantized notation, and remember, when I say first and second quantization, it really is just notation, right? It's not. It's just different formalisms. Then we just mean this, right? And these little tildes underneath mean that this is really psi is really some function of many coordinates for n electrons. Okay, and there's also spin information too, so you can put that in. That's one reason I like second quantization. It's sort of easier to put the spin in many cases, so should put a sum over spin. Okay, so just kind of schematically there. All right, so we know that that's kind of the usual game when you're talking about ground states in regular quantum mechanics, right? So this is the idea here is there's this variational principle. That just says that the actual ground state energy, you know, and here I'm not getting into the issue of maybe having degenerate ground states. So let's just think most of the time for having, if there's just one unique ground state. And if there's not, let's just put some tiny, you know, some kind of small perturbation in a Hamiltonian that picks out one of them over the others or something. You can't always do that, but many times you can. It just says that the actual ground state energy is less than or equal to any value of this functional, you know, for any wave function you put in. So this is really useful because that means that basically all, it's kind of an obvious statement if you just define this as the minimum, of course. But it's really useful to think about it this way because it means that if you work with wave functions, like valid wave functions for your system, you get upper bounds. That's kind of the nice thing about it, right? So you can make up a wave function. This is what you do in Hartree-Fock. You make up a wave function out of a certain class. You try to, you know, shake it and kind of pull on it and push on it until you get the energy to be as low as possible. And you know you have a rigorous upper bound for your ground state energy. And so that's handy to have that bound. And then you can keep trying to add kind of bells and whistles to your wave function and get a tighter and tighter bound. But you know it's always a bound. So that's really nice. Okay, so now let's define the density. And that's going to be the object we want to work with most of the rest of this week. Okay, so let's define the density both in first quantized notation and second quantized. So here I'm going to kind of play fast and loose with spin. Let's just kind of ignore spin for a second. So in first quantized notation, basically the density is where you take the wave function and you just pin down one of the particles at some position r. And then you vary over all the rest. You integrate over the positions of all the rest and take the square of the wave function. right? And then a second quantized notation is even easier to write. You just take your wave function and you just measure this density operator, which is defined to be if you want to put in spin, there it is. It's sum of the spins here. Okay, so you just sort of go somewhere in space and you pull out a particle and you see that it's there and then you put it back in, right? And that's the same as measuring the density. All right, so so the whole idea of DFT is that there is a functional called E of n, and the minimum of E of n is this ground state energy, you know. So basically, it's as literal as it could be, where you're replacing wave functions with densities. So you're saying, okay, let's not try to look in the space of wave functions and kind of shake that functional until we get to the minimum. Let's shake this functional and kind of try to find its minimum in the space of densities. But that seems kind of crazy because, you know, how can you get the same energy with such a, you know, such a simple object, right? Like, this doesn't seem to contain nearly as much information as the wave function. And it doesn't, right? You know, you can't immediately get everything the same way. But, you know, but part of the game here is that's why I emphasize that this is really for electrons or for fermions more generally, is that, you know, for other classes of systems, the density may not contain the same amount of information. But, you know, fermions have these special properties where if you put them in without interactions, they kind of stack up into all these levels. You know, they have stronger properties, right? So that's part of the reason for this. But it's still a pretty surprising fact, right? And of course, the minimum, right? So one property, right? So minimum that this guy gives the ground state energy, and the minimum occurs at the ground state density. Okay, so here we're assuming a non-degenerate ground state. Again, I said that a few times, but just to emphasize, right? And you can, you know, there's ways to handle this degeneracy, but, you know, it just won't be that interesting for us. So I just want to, you know, convey the sort of key ideas about this. So let's not worry too much about that, right? Okay, so now I think a neat fact, and it's like a helpful exercise to kind of convince you guys that this is possible, this rewriting is possible, is to just do it exactly for the case of one electron. So you can actually write down the full density functional for just that one case, right? So it's not interacting by virtue of that there just aren't any other electrons around to interact with, okay? So let's consider okay, and this construction goes by the name of von Weizsacker. So it's this von Weizsacker functional. And this will also convey to you what I mean by functional. Yeah, I should probably spend a minute or two talking about this word, right? So this word gets thrown around a lot. And there's some confusion, I think, sometimes in the DFT community about what it means. Not from the people who do the theory, but just some of the people who use the codes. But kind of what does it mean and what does it not mean, right? So functional, you know, all it means is like, you know, it's a function of a function, right? So it's just a function that acts in the space of other functions, right? So it just eats things that depend on three coordinates, you know, from 3D, and then it gives you a number. That's all it means, right? So that the point is that, you know, it's just a machine, right? It's just a map. So it could be horrible, right? You could maybe never want to see what this map looks like. It could just be a bunch of weird arrows, right? So it's just telling you, you know, you just get N1 of R and you get some E1, you know, N2 of R. That's how you should really think about it. It's just a bunch of arrows. And what we're going to try to figure out is like, you know, how does this map work? Like, is it many to one or kind of one to one or, you know, that's this kind of thing. That's more like what we're after. It's just some kind of formal properties of this map. The reason I'm emphasizing this is to a few things, right? So one is that this functional can depend in crazy ways on n, right? So it can depend both on just, it could be some integral over n. That's kind of the simplest form, and that's like what the LDA essentially is. It's just some integral over n, but maybe n to some funny power or plugged into some more complicated function. Okay, that's basically a preview. That's what LDA is basically about. We'll see in a second, this von Weizsacker is something called like a gradient expansion type of functional, actually, so it's already a beyond LDA type of functional. Then there's other things that the functional could depend on, right? So it could actually depend on the total. Like you could integrate the entire density, get the total number of particles, and put that in, right? You know, sure, why not, right? And then you could use that number to do some complicated process, right? So you could integrate over the whole density, figure out how many particles there are, take that number, go do a Hartree-Fock calculation, constrained to that number, come back and add that energy in. I mean, this functional can do, you know, arbitrary amounts of stuff with this information about the density. So that's kind of partly why it has this power. You know, it could even be horribly non-local, right? It could look at properties of the density very far away and correlate them all together. So it can do anything. And one reason I'm emphasizing this is that, you know, often people talk about, can you write down the functional, right? But, you know, that's maybe somewhat the wrong question. We'll see here we can in one case. But you can also just think of the functional, you could think of it also as a computer algorithm, say. So you could just think of it as you take this thing and then you do some kind of, you throw it into some code on a computer and get an energy out. And that also could be the functional, right? And I'm mentioning that because I've actually done that. So one thing you can do is you can literally just guess and check a bunch of interacting problems and keep solving them until their density matches that and then just read off their energy. So in some sense, that's the functional, right? But that's not very elegant. But it's literally just a guess and check procedure until you just happen to land on the right density, and then you just read off the energy you got. So it could really be anything. Okay, so back to this example of a single electron, right? So to construct this functional, let's just assume that the wave function, also let's just work in 1D for simplicity, okay? So that just means psi is a function of just one coordinate x. Let's assume that psi is real and non-negative everywhere. Okay, and you can question this assumption, but let's just do that, okay? And all I'm claiming is that this functional just works for those kinds of wave functions, right? So I'm not saying that, you know, this is a kind of totally general thing. Let's just assume that, and that's the kind of wave functions and systems I'm talking about. But that covers a lot of cases. Maybe it covers every case. I don't know for ground states, but I'm not going to try to prove that. Let's just assume that. If that's the case, then we know that that if you take psi of x squared, that's the density, right? That's just a simplified version of this expression, right? There's no other guys to integrate over. Oh, yeah. Sorry, these are two separate. This is just my assumption. This is just a more general fact. Yes, okay, right. So that wasn't meaning to say this implies that. I'm assuming this and just mentioning that. Okay, that's always true. Yeah, thanks for pointing that out. Okay, so then this is the part where I need the assumption, right? So with this assumption and this fact, then I can write this, okay? This is my key trick, right? So I can write that the wave function is just the square root of the density. Fine, right? Okay, so that's where I need this assumption. Okay, so now with that assumption, what we want to do is just calculate the kinetic energy of this guy. Okay, so what we'll do is insert a resolution of the identity. And then go into real space. Okay, so you with me so far? So just writing out the kinetic energy. So, you know, I'm just using my kind of, just that first term in the Hamiltonian up there, right? That's in second quantized form. Here I've kind of passed into real space first quantized form. And then I'm not going to go through, you know, the tedious step of calculating the second derivative, but basically, at this point, let's plug in this assumed form that relates the wave function and the density. Okay. So again, you know, it's a bit of an assumption, but it's one that happens to be valid in many cases. Just, you know, and it's just pedagogical, right? Like, you can just try it on the cases where it turns out to be true, and then, you know, it's going to fail for maybe some special cases where it doesn't work. You know, and in particular, you can only really make that relationship go for a single particle. So, you know, this guy, you know, assuming it's real, so this guy becomes, I'm just going to write the results. So when you work this all out, I'm skipping a lot of steps here, but I'm sure you guys can just take derivatives. Okay, so when you just plug this in and just take derivatives through and simplify down, you get this kind of complicated expression, all right? Then I just multiply in this this guy and get I'm pointing out this one step because you need to make one other small assumption here, which is that this part integrates. So here we're integrating dx minus infinity to infinity. And this part just integrates to something that involves looking at n prime just at the boundaries, so just at plus and minus infinity, right? Because this is just a pure derivative. So you get n prime at the boundaries. And one more assumption we want to make is that n prime goes to 0 at plus minus infinity. And that's also, you know, quite reasonable assumption, right? So we can just think of like a simple potential problem where, you know, the wave function just kind of goes away, has like some tails that just vanish out at infinity, right? So we're not looking at anything too funny. Like, so basically, we're not going to look at some kind of, you know, some kind of scattering problem or something where we send in a plane wave from infinity or something like that. So just looking at kind of like a bound state problem. This is all about ground states, right? So then we arrive finally at this expression. This is just for the kinetic energy, right? This guy?
Yeah.
So I just copied this out of my notes, but I probably should have gone through it. I'm just going to leave this as an exercise to you guys to check. I just didn't want to bore you with going through and taking a bunch of derivatives and talking about powers. So so maybe this will just be an exercise to like work out those details. But it's just...
I mean, it should be to reproduce the third row.
Oh, to reproduce the third row. Yeah, then it's probably just a typo in my notes. So thanks for pointing that out. Okay, so anyway, we arrive here, right? And so what we see is that this is a kinetic energy functional. But remember, functionals don't really have to, you know, play by the rules. They can do anything. But this one is pretty simple, right? So so this one, what does it depend on, right? So you could write it as, if you want, t is some function of n of x and n prime of x, right? So it's a functional of n, but then it's really a function of these two, you know, simplified, you know, details about n. So just n itself and the derivative of n. Right, you can just see that explicitly. And again, it's valid for just a single electron. So finally, we can make the energy functional as follows. Because, you know, we can ignore interactions because there's no other particles around. So we can just say that for this case, again, this is called this von Weizsacker functional. You can say that E of n is this T plus this thing called V of n, which is just the following. So let's write it out now. Just V of x times n of x. It's just the potential energy. Okay? So that's it. So that part is this part is always a density functional. So basically, there's like a few lessons in this exact result, just for one electron, right? One is that this shows you that, you know, this just gives you an idea of that there can be such things. So you can actually rewrite complicated things like the kinetic energy in terms of the density. And that when you do this, the rewriting may depend on things like derivatives of the density, right? And so you could think in a more generalized case, like when you have many particles, maybe it depends on many higher derivatives, right? Or maybe it depends on other more complicated expressions involving n. And this is already, again, you know, beyond this local density approximation, which we'll talk about, which only depends on n in some way. So this already depends on n prime. But this is an exact result, so maybe it's not too surprising that it's not equivalent to this local density approximation, which is just an approximation. Another point about this is that, so this is a explicit density functional, and so part of the game that we're going to do is to identify big pieces of the energy that explicitly depend on the density and try to pull those out. So we're going to try to extract any part of the energy that we can find that's sort of very simple to write in terms of the density, put those to the side, and when you're done, you're just left with some kind of core part that is hard to approximate in terms of the density, and then that's the part you kind of go after and you try to develop approximations for, right? So you can kind of learn all those lessons just from this simple example. Yeah, I wondered about that myself. Right, so okay, the question is about the, if you include the phase, varying the phase. So, you know, I haven't worked it out. It'd be interesting to write it down. I have a feeling that if you do that and you know, in the most general case, you basically won't be able to get rid of the phase in a way that you only end up with expressions involving the density. I mean, that's just my kind of passing guess at what will happen. But, I would just basically say maybe in this case it'd be an interesting thing to do. And then see which part depends on the phase, and maybe identify a problem where that plays in a central role or something, like maybe in a scattering problem, this plays in a central role. But again, you know, part of the game here, this maybe emphasizes partly why this is about ground states as well, right? So you can maybe talk about functionals for things that could give you beyond ground state properties, but we're going to be focusing on ground states too. So that's sort of part of it. And you know, we're thinking of kind of bound states also, right? So maybe not only ground states, but sort of ground states where things are bound. So we don't, you know, because, you know, we basically have to assume certain boundary conditions at infinity, is what I'm saying. Okay, so, you know, today we're doing a little bit of history. So that's just one historical kind of pedagogical example of a density functional. So there's another historically important density functional called the Thomas-Fermi approximation. Okay, or this Thomas-Fermi approach. And this one is really old, and so it's actually quite interesting because this is really one of the very earliest attempts to solve quantum mechanics for many particles. So it's kind of neat that way. And, you know, in a way, this is what kind of inspired a lot of the later work on density functionals and kind of gave it some legs. And let me just mention that this is actually still used quite a bit. So there's a community of physicists that is interested in very high temperature phases. So they do these kind of studies of, you know, plasmas or properties of stars and things like this. So, you know, very high temperature gases. And they actually use Thomas Fermi all the time. So it's actually still in heavy use, but it's very crude and doesn't work very well. It's just that in some cases, it's kind of all you can do, because the problem is so complicated. So this was developed, actually, in 1927, right? So very early stuff. So I think at least one of the original papers doesn't mention the Schrodinger equation at all, right? So it's just sort of somehow, like, you know, just put, you know, just still in the days of putting together quantum mechanics. So now let's consider, again, just to kind of get across the main point, let's consider 1D. And a collection of spinless fermions. You know, again, of course, all this can be generalized, but it's just going to make things more tedious and make me likely to make more mistakes and stuff. So let's just, you know, keep it simple. All right. So, so what we want to do is, you know, consider also that they're non-interacting. Right. because then we can actually compute stuff very easily. And then let's just compute their kinetic energy. Of n particles on a ring. So periodic boundary conditions, right? So okay, so this would be something you guys have worked out before. Basically, when you do a Fourier transform of the Hamiltonian, what you find is that basically just the kinetic energy part of the Hamiltonian. So let's just say H equals just kinetic energy here. So we're just flat potential, no interactions. I already said this, non-interacting. Then you can diagonalize the Hamiltonian, and you just get that it has this kind of form. Okay. Or we can think of this as a sum over k's, because we are just on a finite ring of size L. Okay, so if that's the case, then the momenta are quantized in steps of 2 pi n over L, okay, where n is an integer. Okay, and this just has to do with having single valuedness around this finite size ring. Okay. And then in the simplest case, we can just take E of k to have this form, right? So we're already considering that L is very big, right? So of course, on a finite ring, this is going to have some different form, like a cosine. But we're just going to we're going to be eventually taking the limit as L goes to infinity. So we're just going to go ahead and approximate it by this form. So I'm kind of skipping on past this stuff, but this would be something that you guys have seen before. And so then, and we're just kind of developing a crude approximation. So this is what our single particle energies look like. We just have this kind of one band for the whole system. And then what we do is we just fill up these states, right? So we have these states that are, I'm keeping things discrete by having a finite L, just to make it simple to think about. But then we want to take this limit as these become closer and closer together. That's the L goes to infinity limit. So we have all these levels, and they're spaced by 2 pi over L. And then we want to fill up n of them, right? You know, up until some value. And we define the Fermi momentum as just being wherever that filling stops. So whatever momentum we reach when we fill up n particles, we just define that as kf, the Fermi momentum. Okay. So then we can figure out a formula for this kf by just putting all these assumptions together. Right, so this is the size of our Fermi C. Okay, 2kF, right? It's just saying that that's the region and momentum space that we fill, right? And then this is the spacing of these points. So this is just counting how many of these points there are in this region. So that better equal n, right, for this spinless fermion case. So you better have, just for consistency of what we just said, there better be n of these points in this region if they're spaced by that amount. Okay. So what that does is it lets us derive what kf is. And we get pi n over L. And another way of writing that is just pi times the density, right? So that's kind of nice, because then we've gotten L out of our expression, right? So we just kind of used L as a crutch just to make this argument go in a simpler way. So then we can finally say that the kinetic energy is just the sum of all these k's from minus kf to k of k squared over 2, which in the limit as L goes to infinity.
Should be minus kf to kf.
Yep, kf, thank you. Yeah, exactly. And limit that L goes to infinity just becomes this integral. Right, and so then you get a 1/6 times 2 pi. Thank you. And finally, you get. Let's see. So you get your 1/6 pi kf cubed, and then if we plug in this expression, we should get a pi squared now on top over 6 n cubed. There we go. All right, so that's what we were after. This is a good question. So kinetic energy per particle, actually, this should be the total kinetic energy. Thank you. Yeah, I think you're right, actually. So you're saying to get this 1/2 pi, actually, this needs to be 1/L? Yeah, is that right? Okay. Yeah, thanks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. So, right, okay. So then here, for this case of just a uniform gas, we just see that the energy is just a function of the density, right? So this case, it's very simple. We get one of these density functionals that we wanted. But it's only in this very, very simple case again, where we had, you know, non-interacting particles, and the density was totally uniform, it's totally flat, right? So then the Thomas Fermi approximation is that you just replace, you just say, so here, you know, here we had, I'm going to write it as lowercase e of n, because it's like this energy density. We just had that it's pi squared over 6 n cubed. What we're going to do is we're going to take the full expression, so this is uniform case. We're just going to say that the exact guy equals an integral, and I think here, we can actually say it's the total energy, because we're integrating. And we can just replace the density here, which is the density, this flat density for the whole system. We can just put this now varying density inside that function, right? So that's the idea. So what we're just saying, and this is just a totally, you know, uncontrolled approximation, is we're just saying that let's just say that, you know, the density varies very slowly, right? Then if we just kind of zoom in on some patch of the system, that locally it looks flat and uniform. And so then in that patch, we're just going to treat the kinetic energy as just being that of uniform gas with that value, right? And of course, that's not really justified, but, you know, maybe in the limit that the density really does become flat, or if it's just slowly varying enough on some large system, we can justify it, right? And also, it's just something that you can do and just try and see if it works, right? What do you mean? Sorry.
So, like, you know, in the for the unit, the, this uniform one, it's added a pi squared on 6 n cubed.
Right.
If we're going to do the change, then this thing.
Yeah, and sorry, I should have written T, by the way. So let's call this T.
So, do you want to be dividing that by L or something? So,
So here I was just putting lowercase t to emphasize that this would be the kinetic energy density. And so then here it would just be the total when you add it all up. Yeah, exactly. And so we see, of course, if we go back to this uniform case, this integral would give you an overall system size contribution. So we're in good shape. Right. And then so now there's a Thomas Fermi approach, which we're not going to pursue too much, but just for completeness. So that's like a Thomas Fermi approximation for the kinetic energy, which in the tutorial today, you guys are going to kind of play around with that some and test the validity of it in some different cases. And so I think that's an interesting thing to do. So basically, what you're going to see is that in one case, which is the case of a particle in a box, as you add more and more particles in the system, this becomes a better and better approximation, right? So we saw that there's this von Weizsäcker approximation that's actually not, you know, approximation at all. It's valid for a single electron, okay. And actually, you can also use it for two electrons if they have different spin. Okay, that also works just in that case. So it's actually kind of a nice approximation for testing basic facts about density functionals. Okay, and there's also this Thomas Fermi. And interestingly, it's valid in sort of more than one case, right? So it's valid for uniform, non-interacting case. And it's also valid at high densities. Again, non-interacting case. Okay. And then sometimes people try to couple this Thomas Fermi approximation with interactions as follows. So you can try to say that that you know you have this energy functional which you can break up as T, some VEE. And then V, which you can always write, of course. This is always okay. And so then in this Thomas Fermi approximation, you can just use this local expression for the density. So let's say in 1D, you would just write. And then what people do is they will just put in this kind of Hartree form of the interactions. And of course, again, this part is exact, but also kind of trivial, right? So there actually is an approach where people will work with this type of form for the total energy. And it's an approximation kind of like this that people will use when I mentioned that there's actually calculations that people do every day with this kind of functional, where they actually try to look at properties of, say, like very high temperature gases and things like this. I mean, they're sort of finite temperature extensions, but basically they're working with this very crude form. But you know, it's kind of only pretty limited in its usefulness. It actually works surprisingly well if you apply it just to single atoms. You actually see the density has certain, you know, kind of coarse properties, like you kind of see some shell structure, I believe. But basically, it's sort of notoriously, there's, I think, even a theorem that shows that it doesn't bind molecules. So if you try to make, like, diatomic molecules with it, you find that they don't actually bind. So it's just a way too crude of an approximation for that. Hartree-Fock, you know, is already better. But it's just kind of of historical importance. Okay, so I may kind of been early today because what we just got to is I was going to show you guys the Hohenberg-Cohn theorem and then do a whole proof of that, so maybe save that for tomorrow. But let me just kind of introduce it. Okay, so let me just maybe state what Hohenberg-Cohn showed, and that we'll kind of prove it tomorrow. So so now there's this really famous paper of 1964. Here's the reference. And I'd encourage you to read it. These are pretty readable papers, and you can see that it's part of some big program of research that they were undertaking to understand in much more detail, say, properties of the uniform gas, and then of what aspects of the uniform gas apply to non-uniform systems. And so they basically they put the idea of density functionals on a rigorous footing. Okay, and then especially another paper by Cohn and Cham really made it useful as well and practical. And so one key thing to understand about this Hohenberg and Cohn approach to things is that you consider a fixed class of Hamiltonians, right? And that class, you can think of it as, you can call this sort of H sub V. So it's labeled by this one body potential V. And it has this form like T, VEE, and then kind of passing back to first quantized form. It's helpful just to pass back and forth between those sometimes just to emphasize it. So basically, the idea of this class of Hamiltonians is that you think of your control knob if you will, as this one-body external potential. So you think of these as fixed, right? So this is kind of in contrast to, so what we'll be looking at later in this class is lattice models, right? And in lattice models, you might have terms like hopping, and you might have some kind of interactions, this kind of thing. Those kind of mix up a lot of these effects together. So here, you really are kind of down at a more fundamental level. So you're like in the continuum, and your interactions are sort of God-given, right? So these are like microscopically realistic interactions, and you think of them as just there, and you can't change them, you know. And the kinetic energy also is just, you know, the standard expression for the kinetic energy. And all we're doing is we're going to be kind of messing around with this V and seeing what density we get. And the idea is that basically in the end, there's a one-to-one correspondence, and that's what's surprising, right? So, you can almost just kind of think of it, and sometimes you see DFT taught this way, as doing Legendre transforms, right? So the idea is that just as, you know, you'll have, you might pass from variables, say, you work with a fixed particle number, or you work with a chemical potential, say, when you're doing thermodynamics, this kind of thing. So here, basically, V is some kind of, you know, generalized chemical potential coupling to the density, and then you can kind of exchange. You can work in terms of one being fixed or the other being fixed, this kind of thing. That's sort of part of the idea. So that's more apparent if you write this in second quantized form, as we did earlier. Right? So then you can really see, like I said, that V and N kind of couple to each other symmetrically, so you can kind of pass in a formalism where one is the key variable and the other is the key variable, with the other one being held fixed. And so, again, you know, typically, for real problems, as we saw, we've already written this part. And then, of course, for realistic 3D problems, you take this to be the Coulomb interaction. And what we'll prove tomorrow is okay. So they proved rigorously that if you have two Hamiltonians, call it HV and HV prime. So they're just different by the one-body potential that they have. And in short, we could call them H and H prime, same guys. Okay. Then if each has, let's say, assuming each has a non-degenerate ground state, that their ground state, or their ground states, psi and psi prime, have the same density, okay, then that implies that their that V and V prime just differ by a constant shift. So in effect, they're the same, right? So it's just that v equals some v prime plus some c. Okay, so that's what we'll prove tomorrow. Any questions about that? I think you'll see it's a little more interesting tomorrow when we actually go and prove it. So.
Changing those interactions will send you to a different system which has the same ground state densities, one of these things with a different.
Exactly, yeah. Okay, right. So just for the video, I'm going to repeat the question. So question was, you know, what if you change the V especially? You know, so the T, you know, you can change the T as well, but, you know, it's more common that you just think of that as fixed, and we'll see that's the trick we're going to pull, is think of the T as still fixed, but we're going to actually change the V, and in fact, we're going to just get rid of it altogether. So we're going to pass to the case of non-interacting, and we're going to exactly exploit that loophole. So there's this glaring loophole in this whole thing, which is that, and that's why I emphasized it. So really, I should have put that as maybe as another bullet point over there. So it's assuming you have two Hamiltonians. I mean, I kind of did by writing it in this notation. So I said they're both in the same class, where we only label them as being different by their V. That's another key assumption, and then it's really like a loophole. So if you mess around with this V, you move to a different class. And so this whole theorem goes through again. But now you have a second, totally different wave function that has the same density exactly, right? And that's going to be the Cohn-Sham system. So that's it, right? And that was partly one of the main things I want to teach you guys is that, again, if you're working in the field of kinetic matter, you'll see Cohn-Sham systems come up a lot. Like you'll see, maybe I'll show you tomorrow some pictures of these. And I just wanted you to know what they are. So in some sense, they're really very formal constructions that are in this kind of level of formality, right? But a lot of people will point to them on slides at talks, and they'll interpret them as telling you about the system. But at some sense, their connection to the real system is only through this kind of very formal correspondence. And then what we're going to do kind of later in the week is see, you know, on a practical level, though, even though they're only defined in this kind of formal way, as that you play this trick where you remove the interactions and then redo this theorem, that maybe they actually do contain some real information about the system. So maybe you actually can extract some properties of the interacting system from them and not just use them as some intermediate step of some calculation. That's sort of one of my goals.
Actually, did Cohn receive Nobel Prize for development of the density?
Oh yeah, I should have mentioned this, right. Yeah, this is Nobel Prize winning work, actually. Right, exactly.
But as far as I know, in chemistry, for
right? Yes, I think it was in chemistry. Yeah, I think it was also, I think the co-recipient was, it might have been Popel, I think, but it was someone else who worked quite a lot on developing like basis sets for chemical calculations. So the whole theme of that Nobel Prize was sort of computational chemistry and physics. Cohn, definitely, and I think Popel was the other guy. So. Yeah. I think Hohenberg and Sham were, unfortunately, this happens so many times with Nobel Prizes, right? Like people do a lot of the key work and then they're left. This is just a common story with them. Right. Yeah.